Welcome to Rooster Radio. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. Our guest is Australia's top theatre director, the globally acclaimed Simon Phillips. His directing credits range from the contemporary to Shakespearean classics, musicals to opera. He has been the go-to man for shows such as Love Never Dies, Priscilla Queen of the Desert, Cabaret and High Society, to name just a few, and has too many awards to list in this intro. When he's not in Australia, he's at New York's Broadway, London's West End, or en route to another show opening on the other side of the world. Simon is a born director. He started directing classmates as an eight-year-old in New Zealand and hasn't stopped since. His path has included director roles at the State Theatre Company of South Australia, Melbourne Theatre Company, and Opera Australia, and says his rise has been due to a mix of good luck and hard work. Simon talks about what makes a memorable performance, how he deals with criticism, what separates the stars such as actor Jeffrey Rush from the rest, the balance of creative and commercial, and so much more. Enjoy our chat with Simon Phillips.
Simon Phillips, welcome to Rooster Radio.
Thank you.
When you're sitting in the theatre and you personally experience great theatre, describe the emotion. What are you feeling?
Yes, well, that's a really good question, actually, because most of the time when I sit in the theatre, I'm unable to have a pure experience because you're picking every, you know, you're noticing everything. I've lost the ability to look at something without being kind of conscious or interested in how it's being achieved. But I do know that when something, I know that something is amazing when I completely forget about all those things, because the event has me mesmerized in some way. And it's like usually about, there's a breathless quality for me about how something's being achieved or the effect that's being made, or otherwise it's an emotional, you know, an extraordinary emotional experience.
I'm not going to wax lyrical about dramatic terms and theories and philosophies, but there is that idea of, you know, the suspension of disbelief, isn't it? Is trying to take an audience and almost bring them into the action.
Yeah, I think actually it's interesting that you put it like that, James, really, because in a way I always thought of the suspension of disbelief as a contract. It is required of the audience that they suspend their disbelief, because obviously, you know, theatre is a kind of reasonably ridiculous physical idea. It's interesting. It's like a contract. A group of people go into a room and they sit there and they agree to in some way accept what they're seeing as being real for the moment they're seeing it. They go, you know, this is, I'll get the idea that it's being acted out of the way and I will receive the story as a real thing. But the way you describe it is a far more inspiring way.
Layman?
Not remotely.
Hunter.
Yeah. You know, no, some would say crass, but I choose to say, I say mystical. Yeah. No, because if your tendency to, you know, be suspicious of what you're seeing, which is obvious, gets lifted, then that's part of the journey.
So, and I don't know if this is possible, but can you break down what the recipe would be to create this, what you described as breathless or these emotive experiences?
That is, of course, needless to say, if I could give you the recipe, every show I did would be a triumph, you know, like, and we would all be very, very rich. But I think that a lot of that, there are kind of two elements, I think, that go into that experience for an audience, and a show can have a mixture of both or can be almost entirely one or almost entirely the other. So if it taps into a core of an emotional experience that is so profoundly delivered, like this is the actor's craft or art at its zenith, you know, like that. Well, there's probably two sides to that, actually, but you know, if you are completely drawn in to the simulation of emotion that is being delivered by the actor and the subject matter that has engendered it means something to you, then that is a a profound experience. If you, you know, the other side of that is kind of pyrotechnic acting. You know, there is acting that is bravura, that isn't necessarily about emotional connection, but it is a purely entertaining scenario. Then I think that if you can make something, it's partly, you know, because the theater is live and because you know it's live, if something kind of happens in the space that feels like, God, how did that happen? I saw this amazing thing in Adelaide here, actually, in one of the festivals. Like, I remember it because it was one of the first times that a company managed to get the permit to turn out every light in the theater, you know, like all the exit lights, everything was turned out, which is more recently wow. something that people get a bit more permission to do, but it was the very first time that it happened. And so the theater was plunged into complete blackness. And I saw this image. You couldn't work out slowly over like minutes, this image started to come out of the darkness. You go, what is that? And when, you know, slowly it was moving, it was like white. And when you finally got to see what it was a man fucking a swan. It was like, what? It was just like, it was breathtaking. You know, I can still remember this amazing thing, like waiting all this time, being plunged into this state complete. And then, oh, so fantastic. It was great.
I was not expecting that. And I bet you were. No,
right. Yeah.
All right, I'm going to take it back a notch or two in terms of your story. What was your family environment like that allowed, you know, you to become engaged with theatre?
Yep. My mother and father, I grew up in New Zealand, and my mum and dad were English, and they were very Renaissance in their beliefs. Like we were all, you know, I had one brother. It was a very small family unit, and we were kind of all introduced to everything. We all, as a family, played different sports, and we all got taken to the theatre. And I got like really bitten by that theatre thing really, really early.
And were they, you know, overtly artistic and involved in the arts, or it's just a part of their world?
They were overtly interested in the arts. Like, my father was an architect, he stopped doing it really early on, but I can remember as a very small child him acting in some of the local amateur dramatic works. My mother was a screen printer, my father designed sets for the local amateur theatre company, so we were totally, you know, engrossed in it. But because my brother's an electronic engineer and I'm a theatre director, so you just never know what you're going to do, where it's going to go. Yeah.
We've asked this question a few times on Roost Radio, and that is, what was the dinner time routine? What were the discussions that occurred over dinner?
Good question to ask.
Good, James. He's very good.
Well, it's interesting because I feel not that I can really, that is, you know, it's actually not that I can remember what we discussed over dinner, but we rigorously sat down to dinner. We had no television. My parents hired a television for the school holidays. We were not allowed television, you know, during school time. And the rituals around the formality of eating were very clear. You know, you sat down at 6:30 in the evening and you ate dinner and you all talked, and then the whole family got up and did the dishes, you know, afterwards. And so not that I can tell you, and we were rivetingly discussing Nietzsche and Wittgenstein, but I can say that we talked, you know, that did happen. It was very, very clear, yeah.
Got bitten by theatre, as you said. Was there a particular show when you were a kid that you saw that you just like, wow?
To be honest, there wasn't. I can just remember the feeling of going to the theatre, and I can remember like really quite naff things, actually. I can remember a fairy queen or someone coming in on a swing like that's trundled across the stage and kind of thinking, well, what's so magic about that? And sitting right at the back of the theatre and watching an early production of Oliver, I would have been really young, and just we would have been in the circle or something, because I can remember being such a distant kind of glimmering thing. But I can also remember my dad taking me down to the local amateur theatre when he was doing one of the sets and being backstage there, and the smell. I can still remember the smell of, you know, backstage at the theatre, and they always talk about the smell of grease paint, but that was really what it was, you know. It was very vivid for me. And then I started putting on plays when I was like really, you know, 9, 8 or 9. Yeah.
How?
Well, we had some, just get a group of kids at school and go, let's put on this production of, we had, remember we just sent out from Britain this like little series of volumes of what they called potted pantomimes. So they're like 20-minute versions of every kind of fairy story or whatever written in rhyme by some English dude. And I would put on one of those a year at school. I go, let's do this one and, you know, get it organized.
Beyond theatre, but I guess sort of parallel to that, what else was sparking your interest from either literature or films, or were there other parts of this world that you were interested in?
I did my fine arts prelim, actually. Both my parents could draw, and I kind of inherited that. And so I was tossing up when I was approaching going to university, whether I'd go to art school or whether I'd do an arts degree, which I decided erroneously, actually, that I would always be able to draw by myself and that I would never willingly study literature and, you know, languages, which is what my degree was. So I went and did the arts degree, which I really, really completely loved doing. But I've never, you know, pathetically, like I really stopped my artistic pursuits as soon as I started working in the theatre. And but I still collect art and I still spend a lot of time in art galleries. I really get a lot of joy out of that. Yeah.
And I'd imagine, you know, every young kid probably at that age, I mean, you know, my thoughts would be they want to be the lead actor. You know, if you're going to be in a band, you want to be the lead singer. Yeah. Were you ever going down that path? I mean, how did the directing aspect
come
into
it? I don't know. It just did. I did start directing. I did act when I was young. Up until I left university, I did some acting, but I was always a little bit too objective. Like I always, even if I was in something, I was thinking about how it was being done. Maybe it's just control freakism, I don't know, but I was conscious of the making of it.
You couldn't inhabit the character.
That's right. Yeah. Just like a bit of me was on the outside. Yeah. So I was quite good at it in kind of a craft terms, but just never knew it. It just didn't interest me as much. Yeah.
When did it start getting serious? You mentioned it started at 8 or 9, and then at some point
because
you
just
studying.
Suddenly realize, oh, you can actually earn a living doing this, which for ages you didn't. You were just doing it, yeah. But I was kind of I was actually, this sounds a bit up yourself, but I was actually acting in
that Rooster Radio is all about
that. You're allowed to get around
modesty at the door, Simon, so...
I was acting in a Shakespeare at university, and I kind of thought about running away to join the circus when I was about 16. And my parents, you know, said you must do a degree. Like that would be stupid. You'll probably fail. Do a degree. Go. You know, like So which I did, and as I said, I really enjoyed. But while I was at university, I was acting in a show. The Auckland University always did a summer Shakespeare, outdoor Shakespeare. And I was approached by the local professional theatre company to go and join them as an actor when I did that. And it was at that point that I thought, no, like, that is not what I want. You know, like, I could do that, but that's not what I want to do. I want to be a director. And I applied for a grant to go overseas because there really kind of wasn't any way of studying directing in New Zealand. And the Arts Council at that stage had just got sick of all the New Zealanders taking these grants, going overseas and never being seen again, you know, like, so they opened up a place, they arranged for me to get a place at the New Zealand Drama School working alongside the director there, like not as, I did some acting classes, but basically to be which was an incredibly privileged position because or, you know, like I think now of people are going through NIDA and they're one of, you know, six or eight directing students. So everything you do is divided into cherries. But there I was just the dude. Like every if there was a production to be done and it wasn't being done by one of the grown-ups, then I was the person who did it. So it got me started.
In those early days, how would you describe your craft? What was what were you naturally good at? Where were the areas that you felt, you're looking back and like, oh God, I can't believe I used to do things like that?
Yeah, I think probably people would just say it's exactly the same now that I haven't remotely matured. But I was very, very sure of style, I think. You know, like really the works that I'd seen that I'd admired in New Zealand, like was very like incredibly well-honed stylistically and kind of thrilling in a stylistic way. But luckily the guy who ran the New Zealand Drama School at the time, his name was George Webby, and he was not a stylist at all. He was an emotional miniaturist. So he was interested in human behavior. He was brilliant at naturalism and, you know, just how people behaved. And so he was a great person for me to actually work with, because if I'd worked with, you know, one of the directors I admired who was a stylist, yeah, I'd have just doubled that inclination, you know. But he was really into this other stuff. And so I learned a lot from him. And I think that I started to get interested in that side of it.
And sorry to get a bit granular, but can you give a really good example, I guess, of what that means in terms of an actor or a play? So when you sort of mention style, it's the look and feel, or how do you describe style versus the realists?
Well, there's a kind of an element of choreography in putting on any play. Like one of the things that film people who work in film find bemusing about the theater is that everything's in wide shot. They can't work out how you get focus, you know, because you can't go into close up and show the audience. So your craft is guiding the people to look at the right thing at the right time. And the other thing that goes into that is that there's this kind of the way that people move, the way that people embrace the stage and how that works. And that can be it's at work if you're doing something completely naturalistic. You know, like it would never be noticed, but you are subtly shifting the focus and you're actually trying to work out how to make that visual experience sufficiently interesting. But on a much more heightened level, especially if you're doing something that's, you know, a Shakespeare or a Restoration play or, you know, or a farce, you know, like they're all choreographed to some degree. And so then it can be very heightened, you know, like people can move entirely in circles, and I have been known to ask people to do some pretty unlikely physical moves in that respect, because it creates a kind of a spirit for the production. So yeah, you find that, you know, and certain actors respond are really good at that kind of stuff, and others that is just not their forte at all.
In these early years, what was influencing you in terms of where was this style coming from?
I know for a fact there was a small theatre in Auckland called Theatre Corporate that was started by a guy called Raymond Hawthorne who came back from Britain and established this theatre company. It was tiny, like it was 120, maybe 200 seats, I don't know, like really small. Incredibly, really, really highly stylized work. And I had never seen anything like delivered with that degree of panache, I guess. You know, it was just so smart. It was like, and I mean, the people who didn't like that work thought that it was all style and that he wasn't so interested in any of the kind of emotional content of stuff. But I found it very kind of compelling. And actually, in retrospect, he did a lot of like amazing work in that theatre. Like they did Beckett and there's things that aren't, you know, like essentially established with kind of high style. They're high art, but maybe not high style. So I thought that was kind of very influential. And then I did naturally respond to, you know, you know, film like Fellini or Lena Wert Müller or those kind of filmmakers. I found it's just part, maybe part of the fact that I'm also, was also, you know, interested in visual art, or like, you know, that that things that looked incredibly beautiful or you know, combo of beauty and grotesquerie did really just appeal to me, I guess. But yeah.
We fast forward a couple of steps then. What was the first production that put you on the map? And I say map, you know, gave you the public, I guess,
recognition,
yeah.
Look, I was really, really lucky. When I was still at drama school, I met a actor-director guy called Jonathan Hardy, who was visiting New Zealand, and he was, unbeknownst to me or anyone at that time, to become the artistic director of the Mercury Theatre. So I met him at drama school. We really clicked and got on, and he employed me as an associate director at the Mercury when I left drama school when I was 21. So, and in a way that, you know, was perhaps completely irresponsible but unbelievably good for me, he just went, do that. And big, you know, in those terms, in those terms, New Zealand Mercury was the biggest theatre in New Zealand, and I did main stage shows from a really early age. And I know that probably at the end of my first year there, there was a musical was going to be Oliver. And the director dropped out at the last, you know, and he said to me, do you want to do it? And so I did that, and there were 60 people in it, because we got every element of the way the theatre company worked. Like, there were 20 professional actors, and then there were all the kids, and then we got a chorus of actors from elsewhere to be the chorus. And I just got that break, you know, like, so I did that show, and it was a big hit, and it was sort of like, was established, I guess what it really established was a degree of competence that I could be trusted on a show of that scale with that number of people in it, and it would.
And also at an incredibly young age too.
Yeah, it was just that, and yeah, and that was just, like, again, the luck of growing up in New Zealand, doing something that at that stage not that many people were interested in doing.
I'd imagine it would have been a bit sink or swim as well, having got such a great opportunity at a young age. If it hadn't have gone so well, then that it could have actually put you back a number of steps.
I always go, you know, people ask about those things. It's like that, it's so much of it is luck, but if you get the lucky break, if you don't, you have to be equipped to rise to the challenge, because if you don't, then that's it, you know.
So then what was the catalyst to then leave New Zealand?
Probably the fact that I could see the end of every road in New Zealand, because I'd got lucky young. I was like 22, 23 and going, I'd been offered a job, and I'd worked in most of the theatre companies, like, as it turned out, and I just went, I could see the end of my career everywhere I looked. So I did, my wife Carolyn saw an ad in the paper for this position at the WA Academy. So bizarrely, I applied for it. Then I left New Zealand, comedy of errors, and they turned up in New Zealand to interview me, but they didn't tell me they were going to do that until too late. So I was already in Australia, and I was staying with my brother in Melbourne. And so then they, you know, pursued me to Melbourne, and I got that gig. And I reckon that gig was just, I mean, it was like a real kind of complete change of direction for me, because I was directing students at WAPA. But it was also, I think, quite a rash thing for the head of WAPA at that time, Jeff Gibbs. Like, I just think he was taking quite a risk of going, I'll just get this guy because he's young and he seems interesting and vital. And you know, there were students I was teaching who were older than I was, so that was a bit weird.
And did WAPA have the brand and the, you know, was it as a stronger pathway in theatre as it is now?
Well, it was when I went there, which was in the mid-80s, it was all, you know, it was really early in its, I taught the first, you know, like first, okay, second and third years there, you know, really early in its development. But it already had a pretty good reputation, and it garnered, you know, continued to garner one very quickly. Always had that thing of being isolated, which was good.
My wife studied ballet at WAPA.
Oh, yeah? Right. Yeah.
Pity she doesn't like the show. Where's the radio?
Yeah, pity she's never,
she's never listened to this.
Never listened. I can give her
a... You know what? I told her this morning that I was interviewing. She said, actually, I might listen to that episode. So there you go.
For those who don't understand the structure, can you explain how being the head of a theatre company, either the Melbourne Theatre Company, the Adelaide Theatre Company, how does that work?
Yes, well, interesting, because it's been through a little bit of series of states of flux recently, but, you know, every theatre company has at its helm two people essentially, the artistic director and, you know, what used to be called the general manager. Most people won't be called that anymore. They're called the executive director or something that sounds a bit posher. Both formally and informally, the relationship between those people are quite is quite important. Like, as the artistic director of the Melbourne Theatre Company, I was the CEO and I was the artistic director. The general manager ensures that, you know, to the best of their ability, that things come in on budget.
They're like operations.
Yeah. And incredibly important role, like absolutely. Now, in recent years, sometimes theatre companies have thought, why do we, you know, what does this damn artistic director do? And they go, we'll make, some theatre companies make the finance person, the general manager person, the CEO, and the artistic director works, you know, under that person.
Is that like giving a bean counter the sort of license that?
It's weird because to greater or lesser degrees, those people can be what you would call a producerial figure, and I can imagine the extent to which they think I could do this, and it would be far less trouble than having to indulge this arty person, procrastinating artist. You know, I really sympathize with it. I just actually think that it works better. If the artist in charge has to have a great deal of respect for the general manager. Like I had a long standing relationship with Ann Tonks, who was my general manager in Melbourne. And I honestly can say that it was a very equal relationship. And like I couldn't have remotely done the job without her on any level at all, on many artistic levels as well as. And I did listen to her. You know, like I because I'm not really, you know, I'm not hugely numerous or anything, but I really did listen. And under those circs, I just reckon that is, but there's something that you can't define about what it does to the company. You know, like the artistic director cannot ruin the company. They won't be allowed to do that. The board won't let them do it. But the fact that the artistic director is at the head of the company is gunning it, it kind of creates a tone that I think is better than pragmatism being at the head of the company, you know, like however good that pragmatism is. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is the question that James and I were kind of weighing up before this, is this tension between the artistic and the commercial side. I mean, from an outsider's perspective, I would imagine that would be a significant tension, but in reality, what's the balance like in terms of being able to have the creative freedom versus balancing up the books and the commercial aspects?
Yeah, it's fairly, it is at work the whole time. I don't even know that as an artistic director I was that good at it, really. I think that, you know, like I really, when I took over the MTC, the company was in serious financial difficulty. And so I knew that I had to try and get it back on track financially or it was in grave kind of danger. So I always like made sure that that season was commercially viable. And probably to some extent I put some artistic risk or things that I think I might have even loved to do, I put them on the back burner a bit, maybe more than I should have.
So you come in, things are not good commercially. Do you have a vision then in your own mind of the pieces of the puzzle you want to plug in straight away? So what productions do you want to bring in Do you have a long-term understanding of where you're going to go with that, or it's literally just what's in front of me, what's the next thing I have to do? Because, you know, I never would have thought that some of your decisions possibly about what you're going to put on may be influenced by what's going on with the theatre company.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think that...
You came in, like, did you have a plan as to the key productions that you're going to put on over a series of time?
No, right? I didn't. Obviously, there's like a whole lot of complicated things about that. There are a lot of things that I'd have liked to do that have been done by the company in the previous, you know, 7 or 8, 10 years, and the MTC's subscribers have notoriously elephantine memories. So you do something, they say, no, we saw that 20 years ago and we don't need to see it again. So that was out of the question. No, I really had a sense that I felt that, look, the thing about these big theatre companies, the major state theatre companies, is that they are quite necessarily Catholic in what they put on. Like if you put on between, state theatre company, I don't know how many shows they put on right now. These companies put on between 8 and 16 shows a year. MGC, we put on about 12. There's going to be a variety. You can't have like what they would call a company style. This is the kind of thing we do. It's too big. You need to put on too many things and you need to scoop, you need to be getting them from too many places. And on a purely dietary sense, you know, you want the people coming to have a variety of experiences. But what I did feel, the downside of that can be that the theatre company itself kind of doesn't have an identity because it is the sum of these quite often slightly disparate parts. And I thought that was my main objective when I went in to run the MTC. I thought, like, I need it. What I need to do is ensure that it has an incredibly recognisable identity because so that the public begin to know that you know, like I rebranded the company very, very kind of in a quite a fascist way because I wanted the audience to always know when they were coming to see an MTC show that was because the MTC was working out of three different venues. Now, at that, when I took it over, none of them were owned by the MTC. So where you were, it was like, how do you know? How does the audience coming off the street and going to that show know that what the company is that they're coming to see? And this is predicated on the idea that there is a standard which you feel confident if people start to identify that they have always enjoyed shows that come under that banner, then the numbers increase and people go.
On audience, I'm really interested in your approach because, again, as an outsider, I look at it, I'd imagine there's the audience of hardcore arty theatre goers versus the more mainstream theatre goers who will go for the big name type of productions and shows. How do you balance that in terms of appealing to both?
Yeah, totally. Everyone likes a star. Like the arty, the people who'll go to everything, nevertheless, you know, no one is not susceptible to the idea of a star actor. You know, like on one level, I was kind of used to go, there's no trailers for the theatre. There's no way that you can judge whether you think the show is going to be your cup of tea unless, you know, there is for a festival because it's been brought in from somewhere else. But, you know, we're putting on news stuff all the time. So I kind of understand that there's a reassurance, oh, well, I know that I like that actor, so I know they're really, really good, so the likelihood is the show is going to be. So I really kind of understand that. I think that my hope was that, like really early on when I was running the company, I called in a lot of favors from a lot of the star actors I knew and I did quite a lot of star casting. And these people don't want to do a show every year, but they'll do some. And I kind of was hoping that the audience would they'd come because of the actor, but their enjoyment would be far more wide reaching than that. So then it would be less important for them that the star person was in it. And look, you're right. I don't know if I've even answered your question. Like I reckon that there is an audience going public who buy the big musicals, who want four shows a year max, like something really big. They just want the big deal spectacle show. And then there is an audience going public that really ideally like that diet of I want to see. And fuck, some of these people, they go to the MTC and the Malthouse and like the you go, you're our loyal subscriber. No, no, they're not. They're loyally subscribing to two or three theatre companies, which means they're probably going out nearly once to the theatre, like once a week. And you go, this is amazing. You can't. I was always just gobsmacked by their dedication to it, you know, and they're what they will go for. And then there's that crossover. It's like then if you've got someone of great renown in the show, then the people who wouldn't normally go to the theatre come. And yeah. Okay.
And I am going to force you to drop some names here because, you know, some of the people that listen to the show won't put those star names into the plays. They won't be sure of who you had. So I'm going to get you to list off a few of the key big people that you brought in to act.
Yeah, well.
There was, I mean, Geoffrey Rush.
Yeah, Geoffrey's a friend of mine and he's done quite a few shows with me over the years. And Rachel Griffiths came and, you know, came back to Oz and did proof for me at the MTC in that years. Guy Pearce has come back and done shows with the company. David Wenham never got Hugo to leave Sydney. He always went. He came and did a show really early on when I was running the State Theatre of South Australia, actually, and he came into Julius Caesar with me. But he would do one show every 2 years and it would always be an excuse to stay in Sydney rather than be off doing a film. So I never got Hugo. And probably the same with Roxburgh, although I worked with Roxburgh early on too. But yeah.
This is a slight diversion, but I have to ask it because I'm a bit fascinated by why is it that a lot of Australian actors in Hollywood can play the dual role, you know, on screen and also in theatre. Doesn't always seem to be a natural position for American actors why is it, I mean, English seem to be able to do it as well. Why can the Australian actors seem to do both?
I think for nearly all of them, their training, the nature of the training that was available to them was theatre training. So, and there was a, you know, film component in some of those courses, but the essence of the training that all of those actors did was theatre based. And it's the same in Britain. You know, I may be wrong now, you know, maybe specifically film acting courses, but most of them have done more substantial training. Now, like, obviously there are people whereas I think in America, you know, you can train for film, you know, and just you never learn those skills. And it's very definitely easier to downsize to the movies than to upsize from a film training to a theatre, to what's required in the theatre.
These elite performers, you've mentioned some of the names. What is it about them that separates them from the rest, and particularly from a director's perspective? Talent is obvious.
Well, you know, it is. You know, I think that. There are so many damn things that go into answering that question. To be honest, I often think that, it probably varies from person to person a bit as well. Like often I think it's purely obsession, you know, that what really, you know, if talents are given, you know, it's just the sense that people live for something, that is their main source of fuel, that they're not, you know, they're not that capable of a balanced life, that something else is not going to take precedence. You know, I won't, you know, there's a true kind of devotion to the art form. But, you know, that said, there are, you know, both, there are plenty of actors who have family lives or whatever, you know, that's not, they, I don't know how they manage them. No idea how they manage them. But I also, as soon as I start to say, oh, there's this incredible quality of focused emotional intensity, which I feel comes off those people who are so watchable, I think of people with that quality who for one reason or another have not got to be a star. I go, it's so unfair. You know, you go like, you are so as good. But why? Why did that not happen for you? I can't really answer it. You know, the camera, you know, people don't get to be stars of the theatre anywhere without the help of film now. Like, they don't, it's just not a thing. They can be stars of the theatre, but they're not pulling in the audiences until they have a recognisable film or television career. And I think that the camera can sometimes, like, be incredibly helpful in the way that it really loves the look of someone, you know.
When you're a director, do you have the moments where you can sit back and admire the craft of an actor and enjoy what they do? And do you have any specific examples more recently where you've kind of, there's a moment and you just go, that was just a great example of that actor just being great?
Yeah, yeah. It is cool when you know that, you know, and humbling, you know, like, obviously, when you know that you there is nothing you need do. That person is, you know, completely in charge. Sometimes your job is to listen to them talking through the process whereby they get somewhere. But I did a production of this musical called The Drowsy Chaperone, which is particularly kind of joyful, silly musical about musicals, really, which Jeffrey starred in a few years ago. And I'd seen the original production of it on Broadway, where the guy who played the lead was actually one of the guys who'd written it, and he was incredibly good. He was so funny and, like, really whimsical, and, you know, he obviously wrote his own character, so he knew what it was about. And when Jeffrey was doing this, the character has this big kind of meltdown speech in the middle of Act Two. And honestly, I just used to think that Jeffrey elevated it into something that was, he burst the seams of even the ambitions of the writer. You know, he burst the seams of the show by just going, I can dig. You know, like, and Jeffrey is the most, like, into having fun in the theatre of anyone you could, you know, think of. He wants to have a ball. He loves working in live theatre. He loves the relationship with the audience. He, you know, like, he's a big laugher at other people's work. He's all those things. But nevertheless, in this speech, like, I just went, this guy is something else again. You know, he can just, like, rip into the middle of it and suddenly, you know, you've got someone going into a vortex that the show doesn't even need, but it's so much the richer for the fact that that person is going to do that. And, like, I think that most of the great actors that you work with, you just go, wow, you just sit back and go, hands up, you've got it.
We can't, and look, we could talk, there's so many things we could do, and we're mindful that you've got, you know, your 16-hour data to continue with. But we can't get away without talking about Priscilla.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right.
And more recently, North by Northwest. But from a Priscilla point of view, I mean, that's become a smash. It's, you know, I'm not sure how many countries now it's...
Yeah, me neither.
Gone
yeah.
through.
Yeah.
Ballpark.
Oh, it must have done 12 or 15 different territories.
Can you explain the genesis for Priscilla to come about? How did it happen?
Yeah, that is quite a story. Probably being sorry you asked about this.
No.
Yeah.
No, yeah. We love stories.
Yeah. Yeah, no, like I was running the company, the Melbourne Theatre Company, and I got rung by this company, two Australians, Liz Coops and Gary McQuinn, who had a company called Back Row that was working out of London, but they were Australians, and by a series of unusual circumstances, which I will not go into, an English writer-producer had got the rights to, a guy called Alan Scott had got the rights to do a stage show of Priscilla from Stephen Elliott. And he had approached with one of the original producers of Priscilla, had approached Back Row thinking we want to do this show, but we're English and we really, you know, should go to the Australians. So he went to back row and they came to us and I went over to London and met up with everyone. And we started working on it. But Stefan had this kind of idea at the very beginning of the process that it would be interesting to put the kind of the story of Priscilla in some kind of parenthesis. So didn't really want the film to be put on stage. He wanted it to be about more than that, like people. He wanted a kind of a basic kind of Judy Garland, Mickey Rooney, let's put on a show framework in some way, which Alan did from his perspective, which was a producer's. There's this producer and his son wants to put on a musical of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. So, you know, half the show is the show and half of it is the tribulations they go through making the show. The downside of this approach, I need hardly point out, is that it makes it twice as long. You know, like there's twice as much story to tell. And it's also predicated on the idea that everybody knows Priscilla. I didn't really agree with it as an approach because I thought it's a little presumptuous to kind of go, everyone who comes to the show has seen the film, so they will get it, you know. Anyway, Stefan didn't really like that version either, but he came up with his version, which was really about the drag queens on whom the film had been based, trying to put on a version of Priscilla. I was for a little while there between a rock and a hard place, between the two writers' versions of what it should be. But to cut a long story short, fortunately, Sense was seen quite early in the process and we stripped all that away and went back to the idea that we'd put on that, you know, we could just tell the story. And then it's a process of looking at the structure and musicalizing it, like going, what song would work? We need a song here because this is an emotional moment. So let's do this. And God, so many contributions from everyone about how that worked. The original actors, I did a workshop, like a 2-week workshop of it. And we did a huge amount of work just in that time. And a lot of the songs that have ended up in Priscilla were probably suggested, you know, in a way by actors in that workshop who've never been given a single ounce of the royalties. And then we also, another writer was brought on, a kind of ghostwriter writer was brought on. Phil Scott came and did quite a lot of the linking stuff when we started putting it together like that. So it was really...
So it wasn't that you would deliver a script or...
It didn't work like that at all. No musical works exactly like that, but Priscilla was a very particular... Like a musical is made. It's not written and delivered and produced because it's just such a complex form about just how the score and the script interrelate, and you're constantly kind of discovering that if you put that song there, then this doesn't work there. It's like it's a really complicated, for such a frivolous art form, it's incredibly complicated to make it work. And in that case, yeah, it was particularly complicated in that case because in a sense there were two different approaches to script, neither of which really were the right one. And luckily, both the writers kind of at the same moment kind of went, we've barked up the wrong tree here. This is, you know, like, and kind of disappeared. And so we started making it in a different way. And then it was...
So we've got a technician coming in just to adjust Netflix. this is raw podcasting at its finest.
On that, you've kind of touched on it, but I am really interested in how you approach the retelling of a classic, of a story that's been told in many ways. You know, there'd be a portion of an audience that has loved seeing it told in a certain way. And then, you know, are you thinking about how you can put your own personal twist on it? How do you actually approach a classic?
And you're talking about that kind of like or something that's been a film or...
Well, from anywhere. Something where everyone knows the story or has seen it in some way before.
I reckon that, you know, in the theatre then and you're approaching a classic, there's almost an expectation that you're going to have an angle on it. You're like, I would like to, I do, however, have the strong feeling that you need to always keep in mind the person who's never seen it before. So a version of a classic that is, you know, too up itself. You go, what about the person who just does not know that, never knew it? I mean, it's fascinating for people who know it backwards. Oh, like a completely different take on it, but you know, unfair otherwise. But films are harder because there is one blueprint of kind of the film that everyone loved, and working out where you can diverge from it, like what liberties you can take with it, and the moments which you just are duty bound to honor, because if you didn't, you know, the profound sense of disappointment, it's always going to be different because you're doing it live on stage. There's like nothing you can do about that. It's going to be underwhelming. Like on one level, you've got to make the theater version of excitement that was the film version of excitement, like the, you know, the plume, you know, the famous shot of Guy Pearce and Priscilla, you know, going across the desert with the silver plume going behind him. Like, how the fuck are you supposed to do that on a stage? It's ridiculous. When we first did the show, it was like the first version of Priscilla, I really spent a shitload of money trying to make that work because the shoe was on an extender and it came right out over the audience. And I thought, I've done the theater, I've done my best, you know, like I've done the theater version of what this would be. But as the show has toured around the world, that
can't fit it in a truck or a plane.
Yeah, that is long gone. Yeah, yeah.
I know you get asked this question all the time, but, you know, just summarizing some of the key characteristics of the West End, Broadway, and then kind of how that compares to Australia. I'm always interested as to what you perceive the differences are, if any.
Oh, God. I think that, look, on one level, it's a little bit like Main Street shopping now, which is, you know, the depressing thing of wherever you go in the world, the same brand, you know, you go shopping, the same brands are there. So why should I bother, you know, coming to Venezuela to just see the same shops down the main road? So there are obviously, you know, there's a section of all those markets that are now the cookie cutter version of the main musicals. But I think that in terms of where things are made, I think that there are really different national characteristics. I think that the Americans, it is a far more sentimental market, you know, like they really do like their emotional element to be there, and they're susceptible to emotional things that you would expect any you know, proud Australian to disparage.
Yeah.
That is dissipating a little bit with the branding thing. Like there are shows that have come here that I honestly thought might not work in Australia, musicals and things that have come to America. I thought, surely we won't buy it here. It's schlock, you know, but people do go and they do have similar experiences, I guess.
Are we more aligned to, I guess, the English? And I mean, we borrowed.
We would, you'd think so, wouldn't you? You'd go, well, it's that, like the cliche is, you know, irony is that chief quality that the British have that they've given to the Australians and that the Americans were never supposed to have. But of course, then The Simpsons came along and, you know, and South Park and kind of blew us all out of the water in terms of really smart, incredibly smart Seinfeld, like incredibly smart satire. Suddenly came in onto the American market, which was like huge relief. There are political dramas that constantly bomb in America. Like there's an unbelievably interesting show called Saw in London that I just loved. It was about that whole collapse of the financial market, and this is great, went across the ditch, and it was like died within 2 weeks. The Americans just didn't want to know remotely. So I think there's certainly a kind of a dietary thing that, you know, apart from if you're going to see We Will Rock You, which is still running on the West End, you know, and that's a completely different audience from the English theatre audience, which is very, very broad. Like that is a thing. They do go to the theatre, and they have a very, you know, sophisticated palate in that respect.
One thing we haven't covered as yet, the issue of criticism. So,
how dare you?
Yeah. We're on such a high note.
Yeah. No, I know, but like, it has there been, how is that, I guess, receiving criticism throughout your career? How's that evolved for you? Have you, or is it very personal, or have you learned to get a thicker skin? How have you handled it in that progression of your career?
That is a really good question. And I would like, I wish to God that I don't think anyone gets over criticism. I don't think anyone really develops a thick enough skin to deal with the kind of barb of it. You get it in perspective. One of the interesting things that's happened with the internet really is that it has dispelled the myth of the single oracle. You know, like it genuinely, you know, someone looks up to see whether a show's good or not, and they don't get whatever the New York Times said and only read that. I would probably say that the New York Times is probably the only paper left in the world that probably genuinely can affect the fortunes of a show. And not always, you know, there's plenty of shows that have survived the New York Times, but it seems to me to virtually be the only paper that really has that gravitas anymore. So you can kind of go, I don't, you know, now people are going to see someone who loved it alongside someone who hated it, and they're not necessarily going to care whether the person who hated it was the writer. I think it's just, you know, you get it in perspective, you go, this is something that is part and parcel of my life. I have made the decision now not to read press. I don't read it, and I don't read it if people say you got a rave in the, because my experience is that when someone says you got a rave, you read the rave, and there's what the rave has only one, you know, caveat. I didn't like this about it, and that's the thing that sticks in your heart, and you know you feel is incredibly unjust. It's the injustice that, you know, that is so difficult to take, and or then the sense of, I was going to say, but do you know the person who's written this? I've met them. I know who they are. I don't agree, you know, like don't think that they're the oracle, because if you knew them, you would know. Yeah, people have said really good things about criticism. Like there was one critic, I can't remember who was talking about the idea of liking the fact that people got used to him so that then they could decide whether they were going to, you know, reading the review intelligently, go, oh, he hated it, I'm going to love it then, because yeah. I know, you know, what I don't like oysters, you do like oysters. So why do we expect when we go to anything that we're going to all, that there's going to be one person who's going to tell us whether it's good or not, you know? But it's just, it's an occupational hazard, and you kind of know that it has to happen. And I'm kind of glad that it's become a little less actually professionally damaging than it used to be, because it could be tough on a show, and often it was for very dubious reasons that I believe that the critic had been tough on the show. There are certainly some theatre criticism that I read because I now know that the person is an objective opinion that I admire, you know, so I'm kind of interested to know what they think about work other than my own. Yeah, but yeah.
You mentioned that you now don't read any type of review of your work.
Yeah.
Has that always been the case, or did you used to read everything?
I used to read most of it. And what I did when I was running the company was used to say, can someone tell me if an actor's taken a thrashing? Because if the cast had taken a thrashing, if someone in the cast had taken a beating, I, as the artist director, I needed to go in to bathe the wounds, you know, like and take care of them. But you know, I used to read them more than I do now. But slowly over the years, I've just gone, like, it's, look, those things, and you know, like it's just you don't need it in your heart. You don't need to be driving to the shops with some annoying, like, why did she, why did he, why did they say that? That's so not, you know, like, so unfair, blah, blah, blah. You don't need it.
This is going to have to be my last question. And I feel like we could go on for a couple of hours, but who in the world industry do you admire? Do you respect? Do you, would you love to work with if you haven't already one day? Who are some key figures that are just like right up there for you?
Who is there?
You probably worked with them all, so.
Well, with lots of people. I mean, like, it's kind of a little bit, you know, crazy to take a list of, you know, great actors who you think it would be great to work with. You know, like there are plenty of people. Like I've never worked with Kate, and I've never worked with Judy Davis. You know, those are the two great Aussie icons that would be amazing to work with. And internationally, I won't even really bother. These people are, you know, they're there, and they may or may not be interesting to work with. You know, like, they're people I completely think are the most wonderful actors, but you know, you don't know whether in the end they'd be a pain in the ass to work with or not. You just don't know. I really admire, you know, like Mendes and Rupert Gould, as directors that I really think are incredibly smart. And I love the way Mendes has bridged the theatre and film. You know, I just think he did an astonishing filmmaker as well as a great theatre director. Rupert Gould is probably my current favourite, like, theatre director. I think he's smart as hell, yeah.
Last one from me, and it's going to be a tough one. you would have witnessed many extremely memorable moments in theatre. When I ask you, I'm not going to say what is the most memorable, but when I ask the question, what memorable moment comes to your head first?
Told you, it was the guy fucking the swan. No.
Or in one of your own, rather than...
Oh, in one of my own shows.
The swan incident certainly wasn't one of your own.
No. Well, no, that was really just an example of something you just completely gobsmacked by what's coming up in front of you. I think, to be honest, that I've directed Robin Nevin a few times on the stage, and I would say that probably every time I have done so, some more than others, she is the person whose work I just most, I go, that is completely thrilling. There is a danger about where she'll go as a performer that I just find completely captivating. I think she is an astonishingly, astonishing artist. Yeah.
Simon, you're going to have to bear with us. We do about a minute and a half of rapid fire where we just ask some unscripted questions that may or may not.
I have to give one word answer.
And yeah, that fairly short rapid fire.
Yeah, that's doing it. Andrew always lets the team down with this. what's the key for you, the key traveling equipment to make the process go smoothly?
Good coffee.
Yeah. My question is:
ask your stock standard one.
It's not a one. Okay, my stock standard one is your favorite album.
Oh, Harvest, Neil Young. Yeah.
Why the trademark black ensemble?
Yeah, don't have to think in the morning. Yeah.
What about the odd socks?
I can't work in shoes. Never been able to work wearing shoes, and so my socks started to snag. So rather than sensibly just buying black socks, this started to happen, and then it became a habit that I couldn't.
A moment in your theatre career where you think this production can't proceed, or it's a sort of catastrophic failure of equipment or something.
Look, I've never had that, but I've had the worse, actually, because, you know, production does have to go on, and I'm relatively calm in the theatre. I just go, it'll happen, you know, and I've done some hairy things. But I have had the odd, you know, scenario, I can't really be too specific, where you go, this is, production's not going to work. And I know before it opens that it's not going to work. It's going to go down the toilet and I have to endure it, the 6 weeks of it not working. Yeah.
If you weren't in theatre, what would you be doing?
I have no idea. That's a really good question. I think about that quite anxiously sometimes. If I hadn't done this, what would I do? Don't know.
Last one, if you're going to settle in a town or a village or a city or a country, where would that be?
Venice.
Mm,
before it sinks.
Simon, thank you for letting a couple of jocks have a fairly obvious layman type of conversation with you, there's a ton of things we haven't gone into. You do honestly work 16-hour days. You've got stuff going on all over the world. So thank you for taking the time out to give us a snapshot of your life and how you've got to where you've got to. So thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our chat with Simon Phillips. Listen to more episodes with interesting people doing amazing things at roosterradio.biz and sign up to our mailing list so we can keep in touch with our latest news and events. You can also connect with us at facebook.com/roosterradiohq. And if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on iTunes.